From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As the president shuffles his cabinet for a second term, the White House press corps is undergoing its own changing of the guard. At the Washington Post, Amy Goldstein, Mike Allen, and Dana Milbank are moving out. Peter Baker, Jim Vandehei, and Mike Fletcher are moving in. Over the years, we've talked to Dana Milbank many times. One of our favorite stories was his expose of the Goyal foil, named for an Indian reporter who former press secretary Ari Fleischer turned to when he needed to get out of a tight spot. Mr. Goyal could always be relied upon to ask a question about the India-Pakistan dispute, to groans from the rest of the press corps.
But sometimes Dana Milbank himself became news. For instance, when it was his turn to write the White House pool report, a brief synopsis of events written by a designated reporter to be used by the rest of the press corps. Recently, the White House had taken it upon itself to distribute the pool report to friends of the administration everywhere. Milbank fought back by writing this. Time, Marine One pulled up at Andrews, 8:47. Wheels up for Air Force One, 8:57. Number of engines on Air Force One, 4. Time aloft, 1:16. Having your pool report distributed to the White House staff and 1,000 strangers, priceless. Dana, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you.
Is there any story that you've done in your tenure there that stands out for you?
Well, there are many that I'd like to forget, of course, but the one that sort of defined my time on the beat was one in October of 2002, so it was just before the midterm elections, and they put a rather provocative headline on it on the front page and said, "For Bush, the facts are malleable." And the whole White House basically exploded. Then I sort of became their official punching bag.
Yeah, that was a landmark story because you're really the first to observe on the front page of a major newspaper that the administration was filled with liar, liar, pants on fire. Although to suggest that you were kissing cousins before that is probably a stretch. You came to the Post, it was from the New Republic, wasn't it?
Yeah, Wall Street Journal, then the New Republic.
And well, there you were given wide berth to fill your pieces with reporting, but with analysis, point of view, irony, edge, snideness. At the Post, your occasional political notebook pieces were also on the cutting side or even openly mocking of the White House. How did you, unlike a lot of White House reporters, reconcile Dana the reporter with Dana the disgruntled observer of an appalling spectacle?
I think you're correct in saying that sometimes what I'd write would be snide. My editor's word is snarky and often hostile to the administration. But what I hope you're not finding in it is some sort of ideological opinions being expressed in them. It's just sort of a general hostility to power and a constant needling of whoever happens to be in charge at the time. But I decided early on that having sources in the White House was highly overrated. And what you realize with this White House in particular, because things are so nailed down in terms of holding tight to information, that it's hard for them to really punish the reporters they don't like and reward the reporters they like, because basically nobody's getting any information anyway, so you're sort of oddly at liberty to call it as you see it.
Well, I'm glad you made that point, because I've watched a certain number of White House press conferences. There have been very few, but nonetheless, I watched them. And while I understand that that doesn't represent White House reporting in its entirety, that it's only just a little show business slice of it, nonetheless, I came away feeling just embarrassed over the performance of the White House press corps.
You are correct in perceiving that the president and his administration have at times made the White House press corps look sycophantic and even foolish. That is not because the White House press corps is sycophantic or foolish. It's because you have a clever White House that has learned how to play us, and we have had to learn to cover this White House in other ways.
Since the days of the Reagan administration and Mike Deaver, the White House has learned how to control the message of the day. And now in the era of 24-hour cable news coverage, the message of the hour, practically the message of the minute. But what if, beginning with White House news conferences, the press corps decided just not to play along and just to report the news based on what it regards as the news instead of letting the agenda be determined by the White House?
Well, that does happen. I mean, there have been several times on these foreign trips when we know the president's going to take two questions aside, and we know he's going to take the question from AP and Reuters, that we just don't go to the press event because we don't want to be used as props. It seems to me that it's not so much that we're not doing our jobs well, it's that we're not having any impact even when we do our jobs well, and that we've reached a point where people, depending on their ideology, go to different places to get their news, using the web, using their choice of Fox News or of different types of newspapers. They can go to some place that's going to select facts for them to reinforce their preconceived view. This is not a good thing for the mainstream media. It's not a good thing for democracy, I'd argue, but it's happening. Look, we've been reporting all the time about the absence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, the lack of operative ties between al-Qaeda and Iraq. Well, guess what? 75% of people who voted for George W. Bush in this election believe that Iraq was involved in 9/11 or had very close ties to al-Qaeda, and believe that at the time we invaded that country, they had actual weapons or very elaborate programs for producing weapons. So it's not so much a media failing. I think it's the declining impact of what we regard as the mainstream media.
Do you ever shave in the morning and say to yourself, what exactly is the point of going to the White House to report the day's events if every single word I write will be colored incorrectly by readers based on their political point of view?
Well, it's going to happen, no matter who the administration is. We're going to get it either way. I suppose it would be tempting to throw in the towel and say that maybe this century-old experimentation in a neutral, nonpartisan press is going to end in failure with terminally declining circulation and viewership. It seems to me the alternative is to do what I think we've begun to do here at the Post, and that is throw a lot of resources into covering something like the White House to get away from the daily spoon-fed news and to contextualize and present the news in a more accessible and entertaining way.
And what are you going to do now when you get up in the morning?
Well, I'm going to start drinking.
And then when you arrive at work, what will your assignment be?
I'll be doing a twice weekly column in the news section about political Washington, sort of a non-ideological reported column, and I'll be writing more general feature stories as well, but I no longer need dread the late night phone call about what story I did not find that my competitors did.
Well, I must say it has been a real pleasure for 4 years reading your dispatches from the White House and the world, and good luck in your new assignment.
Glad you enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Outgoing White House correspondent Dana Milbank works for The Washington Post.
This month in Time magazine, a report about cabinet nominees quotes a senior administration official. So does an Associated Press article about air pollution as a White House priority, a CNN report about Bernard Kerik, an LA Times piece about Iran's nuclear ambitions, and, well, believe me, I could go on. White House reporters are always citing those anonymous SAOs. It's a term applicable to just about anyone above a certain government pay grade. But how can we figure out which senior administration official is which? Earlier this year, we spoke to Harry Jaffe, national editor at Washingtonian Magazine, who had penned a field guide to the senior administration official, or SAO. So let's go through some of the tips you offer readers in your guide. If the quote, say, concerns the Middle East, who's likely to be the SAO?
If it's the Middle East, I would say Elliot Abrams.
And what if it's about Europe?
The European specialist is Dan Fried.
And how about economic affairs?
This is a sticky wicket here. It used to be that the most talkative one was Greg Mankiw. He's the president's chief economist. He's chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. Then he made a comment that you might recall about the fact that outsourcing jobs was good for the economy. We haven't heard very much from him recently. Good chance it's Rob Nichols, who is the chief spokesman for the Treasury Department.
You know, the reporter could make this whole process a little more transparent by offering those locational guides, for instance, State Department official, Defense Department official, and so forth. But usually the laws of Washington journalism prevent that, don't they?
Well, a deal is cut every time there is an interview. The terms of engagement, whether it is off the record, on background, on deep background, not for attribution. These are part of the negotiations of almost any interview in this town.
And so if they don't say State Department, it means that the reporter was told You just have to attribute this to the administration in its vastness.
Well, I can tell you that every journalist starts with the desire to quote the person by name. It may be hard to grasp, but we journalists actually do like to serve readers, and readers we know want to know who the actual person was behind a quote. So we begin by saying, can we quote you Greg Mankiw? And he says, no. Then how can we quote you? Can I quote you as an economic advisor? No. Can I quote you as someone who is a top official of the Treasury Department? No. How about a senior administration official? Okay. So it's a slippery slope down to a guy walking down the street who happened to take an economics course in college.
Right. So, Harry, the most inflammatory use of the SAO in recent times was in the Bob Novak column. His highly placed senior administration official revealed the identity of then CIA agent Valerie Plame. What can you deduce about that unnamed source using your guide?
Well, I would think that the principal suspect here is Lewis Scooter Libby, who is Dick Cheney's chief of staff. Cheney's shop has the reputation of being more politically attuned and also a little bit more of a bunch of knife fighters. I mean, look, the other name that was on the tips of everybody's tongues in Washington was Karl Rove. This clearly became a very important political matter.
And the release of Valerie Plame's name would be seen as a political move because her husband, Joseph Wilson, had written in the New York Times that Iraq had not sought uranium from Niger as the government had contended.
Joe Wilson became an enemy. Let's use Novak to discredit Joe Wilson. But your question is, and our unanswered question is, and the prosecutor would like to know, who was that SAO?
Would you like to see the abolition of the phrase senior administration official from all newspapers?
Absolutely. I think that there should be names behind quotes as much as possible. Let's at least say that this is a high-ranking official. Give us a department at least. National Security Council, you know, Council of Economic Advisors. I think the question becomes, you know, does it really help the reader to know who is the author of the particular quote? I think yes.
And the likelihood of the disappearance of the SAO from newspapers?
Well, I actually think that it may be a glacial change, but I think that there's pressure on newspaper reporters from inside and from readers. And I think that while it may not happen next week, I think that in the future we're going to see better identification of sources.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Appreciate being with you.
Harry Jaffe is the national editor at The Washingtonian.
Coming up, the pros and cons of reporting by Rolodex and the game of tabloid headline writing, why one urologist is worth five tourists.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Major Strasser has been shot. Round up the usual suspects.
Here's the difference between Captain Renault, prefect of Casablanca Police, and the media. Renault had a whistle. Otherwise, the methodology is pretty much the same. A story breaks, expert analysis is required, turn to the Rolodex and round up the usual suspects. If it's a legal issue, find Alan Dershowitz. If it's an FBI investigation, call ex-G-man James Kallstrom. Conservative politics, William Kristol. Advertising? Well, modesty forbids.
Are there any advertisers that would say that O.J. Simpson could be good for them?
Not any advertiser of substance. You know, this endorsement business is not just about name recognition and notoriety. It's about respect and credibility and likability. And O.J. is never going to regain that. 70% of the American people still thinks the guy got away with murder. It's just not going to happen. You know, they could acquit the Menendez brothers, too, but they're not going to be the Doublemint twins.
Did whoever called me to book that interview call me because I was involved in the O.J. story? No. Because I'd written something especially trenchant on the subject? No. Because I was just the right person to provide context and detail? No, it was because the story concerned advertising pitchmen, and in her Rolodex under A for Advertising, she found my name. And it happens every day in broadcast and print thousands and thousands of times. with varying degrees of suitability and a whole lot of deja vu. Robert Thompson is a professor of journalism and mass media at Syracuse University.
Because journalism goes off at the alarmingly quick rate that it does, people do collect Rolodexes. They're people they know they can get a hold of on a moment's notice. And I think there is this kind of aristocracy of commentators that gets created as a result of it.
I myself have landed in that Burke's peerage of punditry, but there's another one of my peers who is really without peer. He is Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and probably the most quoted non-government official in Washington. He may be listed in a lot of Rolodexes under P for politics and, say, C for Congress. He should be under O, not for Ornstein, but for O negative. He's the universal donor, spilling his life's blood 2,000 to 3,000 times a year. He's been flooded with calls about homeland security, but...
I've had calls on the budget. I've done phone calls on Ben Gilman. I've done things on the farm bill.
You get the point. And Ornstein gets the calls because he's a dependable source on damn near anything, which is handy, but in terms of broadening debate on a given subject, not necessarily ideal. Furthermore, there's the question of actual reporting versus just filling in the blanks. Not to point any fingers, but let's just say it isn't too hard to write a story before conducting an interview, leaving spaces with notations like Ornstein quote here. The king of quotes himself acknowledges that.
I find now, compared to 10, 15, 20 years ago, a lot more laziness on the part of reporters, people who turn to the same sources because they pretty much know what they're going to get and there isn't any use in looking around.
The result, says Professor Thompson, is the usual suspects phenomenon, which for all its advantages to reporters and producers can be antithetical to genuine inquiry.
I think the Rolodex in the end becomes part of the, is one of the most important tools in the toolbox of a good journalist. I think what we may be looking for is a need for that Rolodex to have a more diverse set of voices within it.
For instance, a search of the New York Times database for the past 2 years yields 42 stories, quoting consumer advocate Gene Kimmelman, head of the Washington Office of the Consumers Union. Now, Washington is just lousy with consumer advocates, but Kimmelman rules. Of course, the Times has nothing on the Washington Post, which in the same period quoted Kimmelman 58 times, including on January 23rd, 2001, an astonishing 3 times in 3 separate stories, all on section fronts. That's right, the coveted trifecta. Kimmelman chuckled over his breakfast. Meanwhile, in the Washington Post newsroom, reporter Peter Goodman ambivalently accepted the congratulations of his colleagues because while Kimmelman was the horse that won 3 races in 1 day, Goodman was the jockey in the mount. Yes, one reporter wrote all 3 stories, quoting the same man.
It's both an anomaly and a symptom of a larger problem. There is no question that the beat reporter in Washington is harried and frantic and is too prone to doing the easiest thing, which in this case was reaching someone who's, you know, delightfully easy to get a hold of and who gives good quote. So for that, I'm guilty. We, the members of the media, are guilty. And, you know, I could have... let's be real. You know, I should have worked harder to get some other voices in the paper.
You can't much fault Goodman, to switch back to Professor Thompson's metaphor, if he is guilty of nothing more than using the right tool for the job on 3 separate jobs that happen to coincide. If the job calls for a hammer, you grab a hammer. What reporters and producers need to do, Thompson says, is to keep a large and diverse toolbox so that they're not using a hammer to put in a screw. Strangely, the biggest toolboxes of all probably belong to cable news. For all its notorious sensationalism and superficiality, cable may provide more diversity of expert analysis than the largest newspapers, owing not to its nuanced coverage, we know it doesn't provide that, but simply to its insatiable appetite for ever more experts to fill all those chairs on camera 24 hours a day. Each network has a central database of 50,000 names. So precious is his Rolodex collection to Fox News Channel's chief booker Eric Spinato that each evening before he leaves work, he places his under lock and key.
It could be a janitor. I don't know who's looking through my Rolodexes. They could, again, take someone's home number that if they trusted me with it, how am I? I'm being negligent by leaving it out for others to scour through.
Imagine this scenario. You're at the beach. Your wife is standing with her back to the ocean. Next to her are your seven Rolodexes. You see a huge wave gathering, and it's just about to break. What do you do?
Grab the Rolodexes in one hand and grab the wife's hand on the other and leave. The Rolodex is our life.
That's because while the problems of two people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world, the fate of 50,000 experts and pundits could affect the Hannity and Combs show and Special Report with Brit Hume and the O'Reilly Factor. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but someday and for the rest of your life. Classic New York Daily News headline back in the 70s, Ford to City, Drop Dead. It had a potent political impact. And who can forget the legendary headless body in topless bar that graced the New York Post one day back in 1983? Tabloid papers like the Post and the News depend on big, splashy headlines to push newsstand sales. And there's a science to crafting them. Michael Shane and Mike Pearl, both veteran tabloid journalists, created a card game called Man Bites Dog, which brings the lurid world of sensational journalism to living rooms all over the country. Michael Shane, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, let's give listeners a quick example of how this game is played. I'm going to deal myself five cards.
I'll take five here, too.
Now, you can exchange up to three cards if you don't like what you've been dealt.
That's correct.
Like poker, right?
Exactly. It's just like five-card poker or seven-card stud. You can do it either way.
All right. So what do you have so far?
I have First Lady falls for blind girl. Not bad. I had to throw away one. I had to throw away suspect. I could do... Actually, it was not so bad. Suspect blind girl is sort of fun, isn't it? First Lady falls for suspect blind girl.
No, this is something like poker, but also something like Scrabble, because different words have different point values assigned to them.
Precisely.
For example, blonde is 25 points, but lady is only 5. Why is that?
In the newspaper business, especially in the tabloid business, certain concepts have more reach, more power than others. And blonde is a story about a blonde is going to be far more interesting any day than a story about a cleaning lady.
Okay, no, there are some 50-point cards.
There's some heavy words in those. None is a 50-point word.
Bizarre is another one. Naked.
Naked, always.
Missing is worth 50. Now, here's one I'm a little surprised at. 50 points, urologist.
Oh, please, are you kidding me? The word urologist in a headline is going to make you stop and read that story. Guaranteed.
Okay, falls for is worth 25. Runs off with is worth 50. The lowest scoring cards... among them are Feds, Czar, Tourist, and Wall Street. Now, why don't they have the oomph that urologist has?
Tourist. I think that's probably a reflection of our New York bias. Once again, something happens to a tourist, who cares? Skip right over that story.
Forgive me, I don't want to put words in your mouth or in your hand, but what I'm beginning to understand is that the actual fundamental news value of the story is not what matters, but rather the drama with which this story can be headlined. Am I jumping to conclusions here?
I think that would be fair. How you project a story, especially in a tabloid newspaper with limited space, is really, really important. You're a newsstand sale paper. Papers like The Post and The Daily News don't have a lot of home delivery. You've got to sell papers to people on their way to work. You have to sell them when they're out at lunch. And in a sense, what really matters is the way a story is
projected and not so much what goes on underneath the headline.
Is there something about journalism that we can learn by playing Man Bites Dog?
I think so, and that was really one of the reasons we did it, too. It's to show that there's myths to all these newspapers and all these newspaper stories, and it's true for all newspapers. At the New York Post, our myths are pretty easy. The little guy can be a hero, the rich are unhappy, miracles do happen. At the New York Times, they, too, have their own myths. They have myths like everybody means well. That's why they call everybody Mister, by the way. There's got to be two or three sides to every story, so that you don't get that same kind of good guy, bad guy interplay that you get with a popular press. And this is meant to show you that the popular press traffics not in politics but in ideas, and the ideas are the things that make people common among themselves. It has to do with sex and with death.
All right. Well, Michael, media host, thanks, guest.
Thank you very much.
Michael Shane is co-creator of Man Bites Dog.
Even the most neutral words can carry subtle messages. A team of researchers has developed an algorithm that can predict a writer's sex about 80% of the time based solely on how often they use several simple words like you, the, some, and with. Clive Thompson wrote an article in the Boston Globe about this so-called gender detector.
The basic idea behind it was the discovery that women use personal pronouns a lot more than men do. Words like you, they, he, she. That's actually one of the most revealing indicators. If you were just to count those, you would probably have at least a half chance of being able to figure out whether it was a man or a woman that had written it.
But don't you have a half chance of figuring whether it's a man or a woman even if you don't count any words at all?
Okay, yeah, granted. But that's why they go on to count other things. For example, you look at how many what are called determiners are used. Those are the things like the, some, more, and men use those more. The basic idea behind it, if you talk to the linguists who've looked at this study, is that it's like that old saw that women write about people and men write about things. And it seems crazy and completely hackneyed, and I sort of resistant to the idea a little bit when I first heard about it. But the numbers do add up. If you even go back a couple hundred years and look at the writings of women clerics, they'd be more likely to write sentences that said, I think this is true. Whereas a man would just state it. He would just state this is a fact. You know, he had complete confidence in himself. And so it's the inclusion of those things like I think that begin to introduce more personal pronouns into the way that women historically have written.
So hubris, thy name is man.
Yeah, basically. Exactly.
Actually, the first journal that the researchers submitted this research to rejected it on ideological grounds.
That's right. They thought it was potentially kind of sexist because they said you are suggesting that there are innate differences between men and women, and we don't know if that's true. I got to say, I started off being a little skeptical of this, partly because gender science has a long history of starting off with kind of a weird basic premise, which is that men and men or women and never the twain shall meet. And so when you go out looking for differences between men and women with that as your starting point, well, you're going to find them. I mean, in the same way that you could do a study saying, well, maybe old people and young people write differently. You'd probably find that too, quite frankly. Now, the scientists themselves are very careful. They're walking on eggshells here. They're very careful to say that they're not suggesting any reasons why this happens. They're all, you know, we're just about the numbers. We'll leave it to the philosophers to figure out why men and women do this differently. And that's where the linguists come in and say, well, men and women are trained to talk in different ways.
Now, what's really interesting is that words that you think would actually indicate gender, words that have meaning, words that have an emotional context, or words that pertain to certain subjects, those were eliminated before this evaluation of these pieces began.
Yeah, that's the kind of weird thing about this language analysis stuff. You would think, you know, if you're going to look at something I've written, like an article, that you'd be interested in looking at the major words, like the article I wrote. You think you might pay attention to words like computer or gender or whatever. But when people do these analyses to try and figure out who it was that wrote something, they strip all those big words out. They just leave the little stuff. The theory behind that is that when I'm writing an article, I'm paying attention to the big words. I'm paying attention to the words like computer or artificial intelligence, but I'm not paying attention to how I use words like the and but. Those things are literally unconscious. And because they're unconscious, they leave a fingerprint of who I am.
Well, how much does the intended audience of a piece of writing play into the gender specificity of the text? In other words, if you're writing for a men's magazine or you're writing for a women's magazine, does that muck up the question of these gender signifiers?
Yes, it does, actually. Deborah Tannen, the linguist who writes those books, You Just Don't Understand, Men and Women in Conversation, she studied a lot of how men and women talk differently. And her students once took a look at men's magazines and women's magazines. And it was very easy to spot when someone was trying to write for a men's magazine because they would use these very short sentences. And with women's magazines, they would be longer and they would have more of these pronouns. But the really weird thing was it didn't matter whether a man or a woman had written it, which is to say, when women wrote for the men's magazines, they wrote as if they were trying to be a man communicating to men. So obviously there's some part of, you know, being a man or a woman that's about performing it as opposed to being it.
Okay. Clive, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Clive Thompson is a writer for Slate, the Boston Globe, the New York Times, and others. The computer scientists whose research we just discussed are Moishe Koppel, Shlomo Argamon, Anat Rachel Shimoni, and Jonathan Fine. They wrote two papers about their work, one in the journal Text and one in the journal Literary and Linguistic Computing.
Coming up, I share my pain in a Shaggy Dog story from Hollywood.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. Women's e-news, news every day on issues of particular concern to women with women's perspectives on public policy at womensenews.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The Aviator, directed by Martin Scorsese and starring Leonardo DiCaprio, is calculated to be this year's big Christmas Day release. We'll know soon if that was a smart move. It certainly looks like a holiday blockbuster. In the trailer, Leo is sounding an awful lot like, well, the king of the world.
We are in a street fight, and I'm not going to lose. He owns Pan Am. He owns Comiskey. But he does not own the sky.
Beyond the wealth.
You want me to bribe senators?
I don't want them bribed, Jack. I want them bought.
Other gifts of the season include such films as Ocean's 12 and National Treasure. Typical big-budget fare extruded like so much Play-Doh from the Hollywood Fun Factory. But if Garfield had his way, the movies you see would not be glitzy trifles. They would be small gems that over time became cherished heirlooms. In fact, some years back, Bob headed west to single-handedly change Hollywood. Here's what happened.
In no time at all, I emerge with a four-page treatment for Belgrade, a tale of love and betrayal set against the backdrop of political upheaval in the former Yugoslavia. Not to seem arrogant or anything, but I feel fairly confident in saying it will be the next Casablanca, and it will save Hollywood's soul. The only problem is, I'm not sure I know how to find the right studio to film it.
Paramount Pictures, can I help you?
Is this Paramount Pictures?
Mm-hmm.
May I speak to Mr. Paramount, please?
Mr. Paramount?
Yes, please.
There isn't any Mr. Paramount here, I'm sorry. Paramount was it. It's just a logo name.
Oh. As I say, this being the first time I've saved Hollywood's soul, there are a few subtleties of the industry I'm not thoroughly schooled in.
Story department?
Hi, this is Bob Garfield. Listen, I've got a film idea. It's the next Casablanca.
Right, I need to stop you right here, please, and explain to you what the submission policy for Warner Brothers Studios is, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This office can only accept story material of any type through a licensed literary agent who is also signatory to the Writers Guild of America.
Now, this is the next Casablanca
right,
we're talking about.
Right, I'm going to stop you right now. That's the policy that was established by the Warner Brothers legal department for this office.
Turns out that one of Hollywood's big problems is that it doesn't have a very good mechanism for being made aware of blockbuster ideas that will transform and redeem the industry. Even when you're standing there with a silver platter bearing a transcendent tale of love and betrayal set against the backdrop of political upheaval in the former Yugoslavia, you just can't believe how hard it is getting someone to take you seriously in that town.
Basically, you got to crawl through any entrance, half-open window, or temporarily open door you can find.
Meet Sean Daniel, a former Universal Studios executive who in the past few years has produced such films as Dazed and Confused and Michael. A friend of a friend suggested I call him because the guy really knows the ropes. I'll say he does. Oh, what half-open window would that be, Sean? Look, he isn't explicitly requesting first crack at producing Belgrade. Why would he undermine his own negotiating position? But let's just say he isn't trying too hard to hide his intense interest under a thin veil of avuncular advice.
You mentioned that you have the next Casablanca. When you're out here, I want to hear the story.
Okay, you don't want to hear it right now?
I want you to come out here, be subjected to my and everyone else's penetrating gaze.
You've got a deal.
Okay.
I will be in touch. In touch? I'm going to be in Clover, in Fat City. Hey, baby, in pictures.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to welcome you to the Los Angeles International Airport. The time here is 10:10. We'll be taxiing for a few more minutes and ask for
you can't save anyone's soul from 3,000 miles away. I didn't particularly want to come to L.A., not with all the sharks out here, not with El Nino, not with Nicole's killers still on the loose. But there's still the small formality of getting a producer on board, and that means getting a little face time with the players. My first move, therefore, is to head straight for the Raleigh Studios offices of Sean Daniel. The guy could barely contain his enthusiasm on the phone, and I can certainly envision walking away with a deal. Ensconced in his office, I spin the tale set in the weary, gray, corrupt Serbian capital during pro-democracy demonstrations.
On stage, we see he's famously a bachelor. He's almost monkishly devoted to his ideas. Dragon debate through the first part of the film. He's in his dressing room getting undressed, and she's standing there naked, and this firebrand says, "Don't be a coward. This is time for cowards to step aside and let the heroes come forward." And Alexander says, "Don't mistake vanity for heroism." Alexander remembers that vengeance is an instinct, an itch that you're supposed to scratch. But in any event, he lunges at the shadow who's holding the gun, and he winds up shot. That's the movie.
When I finish, he is visibly startled by the profundity, the poignancy, the simple humanity of what he has heard.
The fact is, it's highly political and full of drama, but a really hard sell. I mean, Bob, Titanic. I thought you were going to come to me with the Lusitania. I mean, this is meaningful, powerful, and important. And as you know, those are the qualities that we don't actually seek out a lot in movie making. And this is a tough one.
Can I ask you one question?
Anything.
Do you validate?
Parking, not your existence.
That, frankly, hurt. I was more or less expecting him to get out his checkbook. But, you know, his loss. I'm offering a timeless piece of art, which it turns out may be precisely my problem.
People who come to Hollywood with a desire to make money, they do very well here. And people who come with a desire to improve the art of cinema or to become artists, they tend to do badly.
Peter Bart, former producer, erstwhile studio executive, and current editor of Daily Variety, tells me to forget trying to save Hollywood's soul because Hollywood doesn't want to be saved. Instead, he encourages me to come up with a movie that a producer will imagine, that the studios will imagine, that the ticket-buying masses will flock to see. The thing is, this is a Thursday, and I have to get back to Washington by Monday for a dental appointment. I ask Peter my odds of leaving town with a deal in my hands.
Everybody's got a chance.
Am I going to make it?
No.
All right, all right. I'm beginning to get the message. By the time I get in to see Ron Shelton, director of Bull Durham, Tin Cup, and White Men Can't Jump, it's pretty obvious that the prospects for Belgrade are not great. But then Ron, who's been through the wars himself, puts the situation in tragic perspective.
Hollywood is in the fast food business. Hollywood is now to movies what McDonald's is to food.
Yeah, it's a Big Mac town, and I'm standing there, in all modesty, with pheasant under glass. But what am I going to do? Give in? Sell out? Prostitute my art? Never. But I could, you know, maybe slightly alter my approach, just a tiny bit, just to get my foot in the door. Maybe with a story that's a little more accessible, one that hits a specified number of sites on the consumer marketing target, a commercial story calculated to appeal to the limited imaginations of the Philistines who run this industry. They want cookie-cutter movies here. So if I'm ever going to get a break, maybe I ought to consider starting with a cookie-cutter movie. And so I tell Ron about this other idea I've been sort of noodling with. It's about a handsome, vacuous, rich guy who gets elected president, but hates it because his wife and campaign manager are now running the country, and he's completely out of the loop. A bird in a gilded cage, a prisoner of the Oval Office, who, just for the subversive thrill of it, starts sneaking out of the White House and pulling an ever-escalating series of pranks, culminating in a bank robbery, disguised, of course, in a rubber mask.
He peels off a 20. She gives him change for the 20. He takes $1.
Excuse me, Secretary
leaves.
McGill. I'm afraid I think you have mischaracterized American policy. American policy is that the compound of the American embassy in
and
Beijing,
at the same time he's reconciled with his wife. So in the end, he even finds true love.
You can get a deal on that one. You can't get a deal on that one. I mean, I'm sure you can get a deal on that one. Because the morons that write the checks can get that. Yeah, that's a very sellable pitch. I mean, you could go to Warner Brothers. I can make a call to Warner Brothers. You could get in there. I'll call right now. Watch this. Hi, it's Ron for Rob.
Incredible. So that's how it'll have to be. Sell the contrived commercial production, then save Hollywood's soul. Ron Shelton gets me into both Warner Brothers and MGM, and sure enough, the Warner executive likes my pitch. He likes the story, he likes my delivery, the gags, the themes. The only trouble he has, his assistant later explains, is the idea of the President of the United States robbing a bank. In other words, just the premise. But then I head over to MGM to meet Gregory Foster, Executive Vice President for Production, who listens very carefully to the White House bandit. Then, just like that, in just the way you always read about, he makes a decision that has a huge impact on my future and my finances, who knows, maybe for years to come. He says no.
It feels like a cookie-cutter movie to me. It feels like a movie that has been conceived to try and hit certain sites on the target to be commercial. It feels enormously calculated. I would pass very quickly. Just say it's not my kind of movie, because it's not.
Well, it looks like that's that. I finally maneuver myself into the offices of the decision makers, chances I'll probably never have again, and walk out with nothing. I have one meeting left with a producer named Al Ruddy, and then it's back to Washington empty-handed. I mean, I'll pitch him, but this guy produced The Godfather, for crying out loud, and 100 other movies. So what's he going to say about the White House bandit?
It's a very nice story, taking a schnook basically at the beginning. And you're going to make him a man of the people by the end. And it makes a great statement, I think. With that idea, yeah, I would probably be interested. It's a very clever idea, really is.
And get this, If I can find a director willing to attach himself to the project, Ruddy will finance a script. In other words, I am that close to selling this movie. Goodbye, Belgrade. Hello, the White House Bandit. But time is running out, so I call a guy named Rick Hess, who's a producer but who used to be an agent and who has been helping me make connections and who has a friend named Russell Mulcahy, the Australian director of The Shadow and Highlander and a bunch of horror flicks, who Rick says is looking to tackle a new genre. And Rick would be happy to fax over my treatments. And the next thing you know...
Message 1 was received at 3:30 p.m. today.
Hi, it's Rick Hess calling. And I just want to let you know that I spoke with Russell Mulcahy. He's very interested in this. He's got people that will finance movies that he wants to do, so this is a great situation for you. Good luck.
Very engaging, warm characters and situations. An original way of telling a story. And a potential for just a highly moving and amusing and warm movie. You can say that, yes, I am interested, and take it from there.
He likes it. He likes it. I needed to find a director, and I found one who wants to shoot the wrong movie. Russell Mulcahy has read both of my treatments, and the one he's infatuated with is Belgrade. Oh, it's a worthy story, of course, the next Casablanca and all that, but I'm pretty sure that Al Ruddy, as a producer, is more interested in a frothy, Washington-based comedy adventure than in, say, A Tale of Love and Betrayal, set against the backdrop of political upheaval in the former Yugoslavia. Actually, I'm very sure.
If you sell that one, you are truly, truly a great storyteller. The subject matter alone stop me in my tracks.
But anyway, so here's the development. Russell loves Belgrade.
He did.
He did.
Is he taking his medicine?
A producer for one movie and a director for another. What the hell do I do now? Do I stack my chips behind the story that has to be told or the story that's apt to be sold to save Hollywood's soul or sell mine?
It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die.
But who says I have to make a decision now? I have that town eating out of my hand. Maybe I'll just kick back for now and watch the Oscars on TV, because next year, you can be damn sure I won't be doing that. Hi, is this the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences? Yes. Hi, this is Bob Garfield calling from National Public Radio in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
Could I reserve 2 seats on the aisle for the Oscars, please?
Are you calling as a member of the Academy? Are you talking about public sale or press, or what are you talking about?
Well, as a winner.
As a winner?
Well, you know, this film will get produced, and then...
If you're a nominee, then you get good seats.
Oh, good,
okay.
Good. What's the dress code?
The formal. Mm-hmm.
I don't want to be too fussy. Do you think the band collar would be okay, or shall I go with the...
I don't know. Okay?
Oh, okay. Thanks for your help.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.
Garfield's Hollywood Saga was produced by Art Silverman and first aired on NPR's All Things Considered. So, Bob.
Yeah, Brooke.
It's been, what, 5-6 years since you did that story?
Mm-hmm.
2 screenplays and turnaround? That's incredible. So, when's the big premiere?
Shut up. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, and Jamie York, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Ann Kosseff. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. WNYC produces On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Have yourself
a merry little Christmas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, dedicated to advancing entrepreneurship across America. On the web at kauffman.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support from the media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.